This is December 4th, 2011, and I'm going to take up a koan, comment on a koan from one of the two biggest collections, and most widely known collections of koans in Zen, document called the Blue Cliff Record. Before we get to that, the specific koan for today, a little bit about koans in general. I think they're unique to Zen. I mean, I'm virtually certain they're unique to Zen. I've never heard of them in any other tradition. The word koan literally means precedent. It's the same word used in China to refer to a legal precedent. So you establish a certain case law and with it precedents, and then future judgments are based on those precedents. Every koan has some puzzling, contradictory element to it. Most koans are dialogues from ancient China that we've, of course, translated into English. They're dialogues between two masters, or between a master and a monk, or any number of combinations. There are a few koans that are based on stories, folk tales from ancient China. I think many people associate Zen with Japan. Zen is a Japanese word, but koans, and in fact what we call Zen, originated in China. The Chinese word, the original word for this tradition of ours, is Chan, C-H-A-N, and then the Japanese rendered it into something more in their own language, Zen. The real essence of the Zen school of Buddhism — there are many schools of Buddhism, but the Zen school has been known historically as the school beyond words. Another way of saying that is it's a school of direct experience. In Zen or Chan, it's not so much the words of the Buddha, what we call the sutras or the scriptures. It's not the words of the Buddha that we're particularly interested in, but the experience of the Buddha, his enlightenment. And in the same way, sutra study, which can be a big part of other Buddhist schools, sutra study is a very distant, secondary practice in Zen. The main thing is the meditation. Meditation is just another word for direct experience. When we're doing real, true meditation, then we're beyond thought. Beyond thought means beyond words. It doesn't mean that we don't have thoughts that traipse through the mind, actually, pretty much continuously. There are thoughts going through the mind. But it really, the hallmark of a real, true Zen meditation is not getting involved with the thoughts. We see them, we're aware of them, we keep getting drawn off into daydreams or thoughts, but the whole point is, once we notice that we're snagged by a thought, is to leave it alone. Get back to the breath practice or the koan practice. So originally, koans were, they still are, dialogues or stories that have some contradictory element to them that doesn't make sense in words. It doesn't make sense in, doesn't make linear sense, or doesn't add up somehow, a koan. And because it doesn't make conventional sense, it has because of this contradictory nature of what is being said or done in a koan, if we take it seriously as an object of meditation, then it has a way of helping free us from the constrictions of this logical mind, the mind of reason, the rational mind that is held in such high regard and has always been in the West. The experience of awakening reveals that this rational mind, lodged or functioning through our prefrontal cortex, is just a small part of our true mind. If we had to filter them just through this logical, rational mind, we would get a very limited, extremely pinched and inaccurate understanding of reality. So these koans, when we take them seriously and don't see them as just riddles or word games, if we really apply our concentration to the koan, then we can find ourselves vaulted into a realm previously unknown to us. And it is that realm it's really, koans are a way to pull the rug out from under us in a way, the rug of our rational minds. It's a way to put us into a state of darkness, really. Darkness meaning not knowing. Because as long as we are clinging to what we think we know, then we foreclose the possibility of discovery, awakening. There's a wonderful metaphor that a Zen teacher of the 20th century came up with. It's quoted in a book called Zen Comments on the Mumonkan by Shibayama Roshi. Here's how it goes. Suppose here is a completely blind man who trudges along leaning on his stick and depending on his intuition. The role of the koan is to mercilessly take the stick away from him and to push him down after turning him around. Now the blind man has lost his sole support. This, of course, would correspond to the mind of logic and reason, and will not know, there it is, not know where to go or how to proceed. He will be thrown into the abyss of despair. In this same way, the koan will mercilessly take away all our intellect and knowledge. In short, the role of the koan is not to lead us to awakening easily, but on the contrary, to make us lose our way and drive us to despair. Well, that would be despair, would be the state of right that happens right before awakening. Most people don't experience this despair, but one certainly working on a koan, you can feel pretty lost. You can feel that you've lost your bearings, and that's what we want in Zen, because you can't discover new things as long as we hold to our known coordinates. Who we are, what we are, the way the world is. When he says, take away all our intellect and knowledge, this does not mean that we lose the functioning of our intellect, or even that we lose our knowledge in any, certainly any permanent way, just means that while we're grappling with the koan, we're concentrating on the koan, then we are free of the noise of the mind and the stuff rattling around that binds us to our delusions. All right, that's enough for overview of koans and their role in Zen. So let's get to the today's koan. It's number 69 in the Blue Cliff Record. By the way, these collections, the Blue Cliff Record is one collection, the Mumon Khan is another, and there are others. These were compiled centuries ago and handed down over time. And for each of these koans, when a student is working on a koan, he or she has to present her understanding of the real gist of the koan, the essence of the koan. And the teacher doesn't have to rely on his or her particular judgment about the student's demonstration, because there are precedents. There are demonstrations that were presented centuries ago, and then that is what the teacher looks for in the student's presentation, is whether it matches close enough the traditional one. Hence the word koan, which means precedent. So this one is called Nansen Draws a Circle. I should use the Chinese. Nanshuan is his original Chinese name. So here's how it goes. Nanshuan, Guizong, and Mayu went together to pay their respects to the national teacher Chu. When they were halfway there, Nanshuan drew a circle on the ground and said, "If you can say a word, I will go on with you. But if not, I, for one, will not go on with you." Guizong sat down inside the circle. Mayu, seeing this, bowed. Nanchuan said, "Then I will not go." And then Guizong said, "What an attitude of mind." So that's it. Now, if that is puzzling to you, it should be. It's a koan. But let's... there are three protagonists in this. Nanshuan is by far the most famous. He's the master in this. And just a few words about him. We've so often read biographical material on him when we address these koans in Taisho. But for those of you who haven't heard of him or don't know, he goes way back to the 8th to 9th centuries. He's one of the most famous of the greatest of the masters, of the Chan masters. He had 17 Dharma successors, and among them, the most famous was the great Joshu, or Zhao Zhou. Nanshuan appears in four koans in the Mumon Khan collection and six in this Blue Cliff Record. Just a little capsule biography of him. We're told here, I'm reading from a great reference book, the Encyclopedia of Eastern Philosophy and Religion. Nanshuan intensively studied Buddhist philosophy before he undertook Zen practice. He went to the great master Ma Zu and came to profound enlightenment under him. Nanxuan built a hut after that. He built a hut and lived on this mountain for more than 30 years in seclusion. More than 30 years in seclusion. And then some Chan monks persuaded him to come down from the mountain, settle in a monastery, and teach. It's said that from then on, the number of students he had were never fewer than 100. That's enough for him for today. We don't have time to read too much biographical material. The other two guys, the first one is Guizong. He, of course, must have lived around the same time. We don't know his dates. His first encounter with a Zen master was the master Fayan said to him, "When a student grasps this teaching, it is said to be like two arrowhead points striking each other in mid-flight, where words and meaning unite in function." Guizong's first Dharma name in China and Japan, you can have different successive Dharma names. His first one was translation is surpassing wisdom, Hui Chao. And when he first met this master Fayan, he asked, "Surpassing wisdom inquires of the master, what is Buddha?" Fayan said, "You are surpassing wisdom." And at these words, Guizong came to enlightenment. What is Buddha? You are. Always remember Buddha, just the word Buddha doesn't refer to the historical person whom we call the Buddha. But Buddha really is another, really means awareness or awakened awareness. So what is awakened awareness? You are. Don't look for it outside yourself. Don't think that it's some place other than here or some time in the future other than right now. A monk once asked Guizong, "What is Buddha?" That's just a classic opening question in an exchange between a master and a monk or two masters. "What is Buddha?" Guizong said, "When I tell you, it becomes something else." There is where we see the insistence in Zen on not getting attached to words. Masters have gone so far as to say, when you utter the word Buddha, you should wash out your mouth with soap. People sometimes ask, you know, these words we use, these synonyms for ultimate reality or the transcendent, the ineffable, words like Buddha nature, true mind, true nature, essential nature, original mind, original nature, aren't these really the same as God? Well, it just depends on how you're using the word God. I think most people, I don't know who can say most, but a lot of people who use the word God use it in reference to an entity. The most primitive reference would be to see God as a man up in heaven. But what I've always found problematic with the word God is it's very difficult not to see God as an agent, an entity, a doer, a creator. Whereas in Awakening reveals that there is no permanent entity anywhere. There's no self, there's no other, unchanging. So, granted, Zen uses these words that you might say are equivalent to a more sophisticated understanding of God as the transcendent, the illimitable. But I think what distinguishes Zen from ordinary understanding of God is the insistence in Zen that as soon as we use any words like true nature or Buddha, then we risk being caught in the word. And that's what Guizong means here. What is Buddha? When I tell you, it becomes something else. It's not, we have to grasp this reality that some call God and some call true nature. We have to grasp it with our whole being, not get caught in the word. Don't mistake the finger for the moon. A monk asks Guizong, inanimate objects expound the Dharma, and the great earth hears it. But when the lion roars, then what? So this is the kind of question that we can be sure that this monk was no beginner. He had come up with something to test Guizong's understanding. When the lion roars, then what? Guizong says, do you hear it? The monk said, in that case, it's the same as inanimate objects. Guizong said, you understand it well. And then the third guy, Mayu, his Japanese name is Mayoku. Let's see what we got for him. Lost my place here. And I'll just pluck out a couple of exchanges here with this Mayu. Same for him, no dates, but of course the same time. Mayu asked a monk, where did you come from? The monk didn't understand. Mayu asked again, where did you come from? Monk, hey! Mayu got down from his seat and grabbed the monk, saying, look here! When I ask you to demonstrate the Buddha Dharma, just give me an answer. The monk said, like an eyeless teacher. Mayu let go of the monk and said, I'll spare you your life and let you breathe. The monk bowed. Mayu tried to grab the monk again, but the monk shook his sleeves and left the hall. Mayu said, don't pick the 3-year bamboo. Get the 10,000-year pine. Don't pick the 3-year bamboo. Get the 10,000-year pine. Don't settle for the quick fix. This is one of the great, great obstructions, hindrances that we face as Americans with our craving for immediate results, the quick fix. Don't Don't settle for that. Take the long view. Don't settle for anything less than the ultimate. These koans are basically metaphors. And that's the work of a student working with a koan, is to grasp the teaching or the truth embodied in the metaphor. There's also a lot of cultural references in these koans that are would be lost on us without the help of a teacher who has gone through them and come to understand through his teacher. And all right, I'm going to stop there because we have other things to get into. And so we'll begin again. Nanchuan, Guizong, and Mayu went together to pay their respects to the national teacher, Chu. There was a period of centuries in China and Japan, both, when the emperor, remember these were empires, and they had the absolute ruler in the person of the emperor, where the emperor would appoint a national teacher. He would designate one Chan master to be teaching at the court, to be available to the emperor, and is of course a great honor to receive this kind of distinction. And that's who these three guys were going to do, to pay their respects to this renowned national teacher Chu. I don't know. I don't have any material on this guy. So on their way, these three, when they were halfway there, Nanchuan drew a circle on the ground and said, "If you can say a word, I will go on with you." The circle is just about the only symbol in Zen. Offhand, I can't think of any others, but because of the emphasis in Zen on direct experience, we don't traffic in symbols so much, other than words. We do these great collections of koans, of course, are all words. But there's a lot less... the circle is just about the only one. Certainly the central symbol in Zen. It's so important because it seems that the circle is about as close as we can come to representing in form our true nature, our mind of wholeness and perfection. You could say that with the raksu, the bib-like vestments that some of us wear with our robes, the most important part of the raksu is the ring, representing as it does this true mind of ours, this unlimited, ultimately incomprehensible, boundless, featureless true mind. Something about a circle has this that just expresses perfection. you can't have more of a circle or less of a circle. A circle is a circle. It can be larger or smaller, but every circle, no matter what size, is perfect just as it is. It's also without beginning or end. That also can be understood as a reference to our true nature. So the first point in this koan is to present one's understanding of what Nanchuan meant when he drew a circle on the ground. Of course, the circle is one of the great classical symbols in many cultures. The great Native American Chief Black Elk said the following: "You have noticed that everything an Indian does is a circle, and that is because the power of the world always works in circles, and everything tries to be round. The sky is round, and I have heard that the earth is round like a ball, and so are all the stars. The wind, in its greatest power, whirls. Birds make their nests in circles, for theirs is the same religion as ours. The sun comes forth and goes down again in a circle. The moon does the same, and both are round. Even the seasons form a great circle in their changing, and always come back to where they were. The life of a man is a circle from childhood to childhood, and so it is in everything where power moves." This is one of the aspects of wisdom. The wisdom that comes with age is seeing how much things move in circles, how much things come back. It is also a kind of a symbol for karma, the law of causation. That everything we do, everything we say, everything we think returns to us in a way. Those with faith in karma, the law of causation, if we had complete faith in it, we would never worry about giving away too much, because it all comes back. It will all come back. If you can say a word, I'll go on with you. But if not, I, for one, will not go on with you. So it's a challenge. He wants these other two to show their understanding of Zen. That's in many koans, most of them, surely. There's a challenge for the student to demonstrate what cannot be encompassed in words. Often, the response is in words, but it's not the words that count. It's what's behind the words. So, Guizong, the first student, sat down inside the circle. What is he saying with that sitting in the circle? What is any of us saying when we sit? Some of the most famous words of the great Japanese Zen master Dogen were the following. When even just one person at one time sits egolessly in Zazen, he becomes imperceptibly one with each and all the many things and permeates completely all time, so that within the limitless universe, throughout past, future, and present, he is performing the eternal and ceaseless work of guiding beings to enlightenment. It's one of the major leaps of faith, certainly to Westerners, is that in our sitting, we are actually connecting to all beings. We are reaching out to all beings. We are radiating the luster of our true mind to all beings. This is so hard for most people, certainly beginners, to accept this, because it seems like we're turning away from the world. I mean, it appears that way visually, especially if we're facing a wall. It seems to be we're turning our back on the world. And no one could ever prove this empirically, but the truth is that we are embracing the world in our sitting. Certainly, if we're beyond thought, if we're sitting and daydreaming, it's not the same. You can't just go through the motions, sit and think about whatever. That's not what Dogen means here when he says performing the eternal and ceaseless work of guiding beings to enlightenment. Dogen lived in a time of great civil unrest in Japan, when there was a lot of strife and clan warfare, and there were a few who criticized him for not getting involved, not engaging with the strife, doing more to work with people and for peace. And his answer was, I want to become a beacon of light, radiating this power of mind, a mind free of ideas, concepts, which really means free of self. There are the social benefits of sitting. These are more... people can grasp these benefits more. It's when we sit every day and settle the mind, we develop a calmness and a centeredness, and little by little a less selfishness, less self-centeredness, that then moves like waves into our circles of friends and colleagues, co-workers. People will notice the change in you, and that will have of course, a positive effect. But then it's this spiritual effect of being a beacon, of in our sitting, by purifying our own mind. In purifying this mind, we are purifying all minds. Okay, most people will hear that with skepticism, but I just throw it out there because it's true. I went through a lot of anguish in my early years here at the center of working through issues with my mother. And I went to once to Doksan with Roshi Kaplow and during Sesshin, and I was sobbing about having seen certain things from my teenage years when my mother and I tortured each other emotionally. And he said, just your sitting is helping your mother a great deal. The way I framed it in Doksan is I could see how much pain she was in and had always been in. And I was saying something to him about how I can help her. And he said, just through your sitting alone, you are helping her. I sort of took it on faith at the time. I didn't see what else I could do to reach her. But I came to see that he was right. So Guizong sat down inside the circle. The Zen Master Hakuin, who was sort of the other great luminary in Japanese Zen, he once declared, "I am the sun and the moon and the stars and the wide, wide earth." This is our condition. This is our nature when the mind is not divided with thoughts. Nothing is apart from us. And then the second student, Mayu, seeing Guizong sit inside the circle, bowed. We do bows here at different times, starting with walking in the Zendo. We make a standing bow, and of course at other times we do it going to Doksan. The teacher and student bow to each other. New people may feel that they're just going through some kind of Asian ritual. And if they have enough faith in the tradition, they'll do it. They'll make they'll do the bowing, but it may feel artificial. They may feel self-conscious when they do this bowing. It's a great day when you reach the point where the bow becomes really meaningful. And to really derive the meaning or the essence of bowing, one has to do it without thoughts in the mind. This makes all the difference in the world. As long as you're thinking about yourself self-consciously, or whether you're doing it right, or how you appear to others, these are all thoughts that will get in the way of really grasping the essence of bowing. And you could explain it in terms of it symbolizes bringing opposites together, bringing all dichotomies together into one, transcending dualistic ideas of reality. I think of the words of the great Taoist sage Xuanzi, who said, "Behind the divisible, there is always something indivisible. Behind the disputable, there is always something indisputable." Well, you could see placing the hands palm to palm as that, and then bowing as lowering one's head in respect to the other person or the Buddha on the altar. But all of this just goes around the periphery of really understanding what a bow is. All we have to do is do it with the mind empty, with no thoughts in the mind. Then we embody the real spirit, the real meaning of the bow. Sometimes people bow, and as they're bowing, they say, "Thank you." That's superfluous. The bow is saying thank you. Please don't mar the simplicity, the profound simplicity of the bow by saying thank you. The bow says it. When we bow to the Buddha on the altar, we're not just paying homage to this guy who came to supreme perfect enlightenment, although that's part of it. It's not part of it. But when we bow to the Buddha, we are acknowledging, we are affirming our identity with the Buddha. That is, we're affirming our Buddha nature, our enlightened nature. We're also, just visually, we're being reminded of the nobility of this true nature of ours, the dignity, the composure, the aplomb, the stability, the straightness and alignment and poise of this true nature of ours. Even when we don't feel like we're living out of that true nature, it's just a reminder every time of who we really are. And then, after each presents his simple demonstration, Nanchuan says, "Then I will not go." It would seem, on the surface, that Nanchuan is not approving of their demonstrations. He sets the terms. If you can give me a true word, a word not to be taken literally, a true demonstration of the spirit of Zen, then we'll continue. But if you don't, then I'm not going with you. So for him to say, "Then I will not go," implies to those who look at this rationally and logically that he doesn't approve of their demonstrations. But hold on. Just a little while ago, before I began talking, all together we recited the Hakuin chant in praise of Zazen, and in it, Hakuin says, "Our form now being no form, in going and returning we never leave home." And then finally, Guizong gets the final word. He says, "What an attitude of mind." This is not an important point of the koan, but it's something that the student can appreciate in working on the koan, what Guizong is, what he means by this. Well, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.